Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
8 years ago, a team of researchers launched a project to carefully repeat early and influential lab experiments in cancer research. The Reproducibility Project, as it is called, recreated 50 experiments. Now, it reports that about half of the experiments did not produce the results reported originally. The reproducibility of experiments and confirmation of results is central to wide acceptance of scientific claims. The truth is, we fool ourselves. Most of what we claim is novel or significant is no such thing, said Dr. Vinay Prasad. He is a cancer doctor and researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, and was not involved in the project. Most scientists believe that the strongest findings come from experiments that can be repeated with similar results. But there is little reason for researchers to share methods and data so others can confirm the work, said Marcia McNutt. She is president of the National Academy of Sciences. Researchers lose respect in the scientific community if their results do not hold up to careful study, she added. For the project, the researchers tried to repeat experiments from cancer biology papers. The papers had appeared in major scientific publications, including Nature and Cell, from 2010 to 2012. Overall, 54% of the original findings failed to meet conditions set by the Reproducibility Project. The team's study appears in the journal eLife. The nonprofit eLife receives support from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which also supports the Associated Press Health and Science Department. Among the studies that did not hold up was one that claimed a link between a stomach bacteria and colon cancer. Another claimed a drug had shrunk tumors in mice. And a third was a mouse study of a possible prostate cancer drug. This is the second major study by the Reproducibility Project. In 2015, they found similar problems when they tried to repeat experiments in psychology. Study co-writer Brian Nosek of the Center for Open Science said it can be wasteful to move forward without first doing the work to repeat findings. The researchers tried to limit differences in how the cancer experiments were carried out. Often, they could not get help from the scientists who did the original work. They could not get answers to questions such as which kinds of mice to use or where to find specially engineered tumor cells. Michael Lauer is a deputy director of research at the National Institutes of Health. He said, "I wasn't surprised, but it is concerning that about a third of scientists were not helpful, and in some cases, were beyond not helpful." Lauer added that the NIH plans to require data sharing among organizations to which it provides support in 2023. Dr. Glenn Begley is a biotechnology advisor and former head of cancer research at drugmaker Amgen. 10 years ago, He and other scientists at Amgen reported even lower rates of confirmation when they tried to repeat published cancer experiments. Cancer research is difficult, Begley said. He added that it is very easy for researchers to be attracted to results that look exciting and provocative, results that appear to further support their favorite idea as to how cancer should work, but that are just wrong.
Grapes from the Napa area of California make some of the world's most famous wines. But what happens when nearby fires create smoke that destroys the taste of the grapes? Nicholas Quill is a winemaker, and he did not want to find out. He remembered that when fires came near in 2017, his wine had smoky flavors that most people did not like. So last year, he hurried to pick all of the Merlot and Malbec grapes he was growing nearby. But he was too late, and his grapes, once again, had a strange, smoky flavor. The smoke can change the chemistry of the grapes and change their taste. Quill is the winemaker who runs Crimson Wine Group. Instead of throwing away the wine, he worked with Hangar One Vodka to make a new alcohol from the smoky wine. He sent the vodka maker some bottles of wine, and they made a new product called Smoke Point Vodka. Emily Webster works for Hangar One. She called the vodka gorgeous. Some money from selling the vodka will go to the California Fire Foundation. Michael Kudra is a bartender in San Francisco. The Reuters news agency asked him to taste the new vodka. He said it was smooth, and the drink reminded him of how the air smells when someone far away is cooking with fire. Quill said his winemaking business lost money because of the bad-tasting grapes, but he is happy to know that he can make vodka again in the future if the smoke comes too close. Scientists say the chance of fire in Northern California is growing because of long periods without rain and extreme heat resulting from climate change. Quill said if the fires happen more often, the vodka option needs to be on the table. I'm Dan Friedel.
Scientists have reported new progress in creating pre-embryo models from stem cells in a laboratory. Stem cells are simple cells in the body that can develop into one of many specialized cells. Researchers say the models can provide an effective and ethical way to study human development and to seek new discoveries in reproductive technology. The latest efforts are described in a study that recently appeared in the publication Nature. The lab-created pre-embryo structures are called blastoids. They act as a model for blastocysts, collections of cells that form during the early period of human embryonic development. Blastocysts form a few days after an egg has been fertilized, but before it attaches to the uterus to become an embryo. Scientists have successfully used human cell material to create pre-embryos. Nicola Rivon is a researcher at the Austrian Academy of Sciences who helped lead the study. He said the models are a very good research alternative to human embryos. This is partly because donated embryos are hard to get and can be difficult to work with in a lab. Rivon said it is extremely difficult to use human embryos to make molecule and gene discoveries in a lab. He added that this limits the ability of scientists to better understand development and also make biomedical discoveries. But Rivon said lab-created versions can be made, changed, and studied in large numbers to expand human embryonic research. This opens the possibility for new scientific and biomedical discoveries, he added. For example, Rivon said studying blastoids could lead to the development of birth control treatments that do not contain hormones. To create the blastoids, Rivon said his team used two different kinds of stem cells: embryonic stem cells from already established cell lines and stem cells reprogrammed from adult cells. No new embryonic cell lines were made for the research. Rivon said blastocysts were grown separately to compare them side by side with the lab-created structures. The study showed that the blastoids effectively reproduced important parts of early embryo development. Some were placed in contact with cells from the lining of a uterus that had been given hormones. About half of the blastoids attached to the cells and started to grow in the same way as blastocysts would. Rivon said the researchers stopped the blastoid growth after 13 days and examined the cells. At that point, he said the collection of cells did not show the level of growth or organization that would be expected after 13 days in an embryo. Rivon said ethical concerns were also considered. A 14-day rule has long guided researchers growing embryos in the lab. Earlier this year, the International Society for Stem Cell Research urged changes to the rule in limited cases. Rivon said blastoids are not subject to that rule, but he noted the guidelines state that they should never be placed into an animal or human. It is very clear that blastoids are not embryos, and if they are not, then why would we apply the 14 days rule to these structures? He said. But Rivon added that his team decided to stop after 13 days for the sake of transparency and for making sure things are very well understood by the public. Magdalena Zernicka-Gutz is an expert in stem cell biology at the University of Cambridge in Britain. She was not involved in the study. Zernicka-Gutz noted that it is not the first time scientists have created a human blastoid. But she noted that every single step is significant in helping researchers improve the process and create better models. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Soon after the Civil War ended in 1865, thousands of Americans began to move west to settle the land. The great movement of settlers continued for almost 40 years. The Great Empty West, in time, became fully settled. The discovery of gold had already started a great movement to California. Robert Bostick and Leo Scully tell about the gold rush and the important part cowboys played in settling the West.
Men had rushed to the gold fields with hopes of becoming rich. A few found gold. The others found only hard work and high prices. When their money was gone, they gave up the search for gold. But they stayed in California to become farmers or businessmen or laborers. Some never gave up the search for riches. They moved back toward the east, searching for gold and silver in the wild country between California and the Mississippi River.
Each new gold rush brought more people from the east. Mining camps quickly grew into towns with stores, hotels, even newspapers. Most of these towns, however, lived only as long as gold was easy to find. Then they began to die. In some of the gold centers, big mining companies bought up all the land from those who first claimed it. These companies brought in mining machines that could dig out the gold from deep underground and separate it from the rock that held it. These companies needed equipment and other supplies. Transportation companies were formed. They carried supplies to the mining camps in huge wagon trains pulled by slow-moving oxen. Roads were built, and in some places, railroads.
The great wealth taken from the gold and silver mines was usually invested in other businesses. Shipping, railroads, factories, stores, land companies. More jobs were created in the West, and living conditions got better. More and more people decided to leave the crowded East for a new life in the West. But the big Eastern cities continued to grow. New factories and industrial centers were built. People moved from the farms to find work
in the cities. The growth of these industrial centers created a big demand for food, especially meat. Chicago quickly became the heart of the meat industry. Railroads brought animals to Chicago, where packing companies killed them and prepared the meat for eastern markets. Special railroad cars kept the meat cold so it would remain fresh until sold. As the meat industry grew, the demand for fresh meat increased. More and more cattle were needed.
There were millions of cattle in Texas, but no way to get them to the eastern markets. The closest point on the railroad was Sedalia, Missouri, more than 1,000 kilometers away. Some cattlemen believed it might be possible to walk cattle to the railroad, letting them feed on the open grassland along the way. Early in 1866, a group of Texas cattlemen decided to try this. They put together a huge herd of more than 260,000 cattle and set out for Sedalia.
There were many problems on that first cattle drive. The country was rough, grass and water sometimes hard to find. Bandits and Indians followed the herd, trying to steal cattle. Farmers had put up fences in some areas, blocking the way. Most of the great herd was lost along the way, but the cattlemen believed they had proved that cattle could be walked long distances to the railroad. They believed a better way to the railroad could be found, with plenty of grass and water.
The cattlemen got the Kansas Pacific Railroad to extend its line west to Abilene, Kansas. There was a good trail from Texas to Abilene. Cattlemen began moving their herds up this trail, across the Oklahoma Territory, and into Kansas. At Abilene, the cattle were put on trains and carried to Chicago. In the next 4 years, more than 1.5 million cattle were moved north over the Chisholm Trail to Kansas. Other trails were found as the railroad moved farther west.
Trail drives usually began with the spring roundup. Cattlemen would send out cowboys to search the open grasslands for their animals. As the cattle were brought in, the young animals were branded, marked, to show who owned them. Then they were released with their mothers to spend another year in the open country. The other cattle were put together for the long drive to Kansas. Usually they were moved in groups of 2,500 to 5,000 animals. 12 to 20 cowboys took them up the trail.
The cowboys worked hard on a trail drive. They had to keep the herd together day and night and protect it from bad men and Indians. They had to keep the cattle from moving too fast or running away. If they moved too fast, they would lose weight and their owner would not get as much money for them. The cowboys would walk the cattle only 20 to 30 kilometers a day. The cattle could feed all night and part of the morning before starting each day. If the grass was good and the herd moved slowly, the cattle would get heavier and bring more money. In the early 1880s, the price of cattle rose to $50 each, and many cattlemen became rich. Business was so good that a $5,000 investment in the cattle industry could make $45,000 in 4 years. More and more people began raising cattle, and early cattlemen greatly increased the size of their herds. Within a few years, there was not enough grass for all the cattle, especially along the trails. There was so much meat that the price began to fall. There were two severe winters that killed hundreds of thousands of cattle. An extremely dry summer killed the grass, and thousands more died of hunger. The cattle industry itself almost died. Cattlemen also had problems with farmers and sheepmen. Farmers coming west would claim grassland used by the cattle growers. They would put up fences and plow up the land to plant crops. Other settlers brought huge herds of sheep to compete with cattle for the grass, and the sheep always won. Cattle would not eat grass where sheep had eaten. Violence broke out. Cattle growers fought the farmers and sheepmen for control of the land. The cattlemen finally had to settle land of their own, putting up fences and cutting the size of their herds. They no longer could let their cattle run free on public lands. By the late 1800s, the years of the cowboys were ending. But the story of the cowboy and his difficult life would not be forgotten. Even today, the cowboy lives in movies, on television, and in books. When one thinks of the Wild West of America, he does not think of the miners who opened the way to the West. Nor does he think of the men who struggled to build the first railroads across the wild land. And one does not think of the farmers who pushed slowly westward to fence, plow, and plant the land. The words Wild West bring to mind just one character, the cowboy. His difficult fight to protect his cattle on the long trail was an exciting story. It has been told by many writers. Perhaps the best known was a young Easterner, Owen Wister. He worked as a cattleman for several years, then wrote about the heroic life of the cowboy in a book called The Virginian. Another Easterner who came west to learn about the cowboy was the artist Frederick Remington. Remington was a cowboy for only 2 years, but he spent the rest of his life painting pictures of the West and writing about it. His exciting works made the West and the cowboy come to life for millions who never saw a real cowboy. The cowboy has also lived in music. He had his own kind of songs that told of his problems, his hopes, and his feelings.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.